dry, and a chill returned when he thought about what lay beyond the now concealed glass. But he knew the only way to beat this thing was to confront it. That was the lesson life had taught him. Be bold. Confront the enemy. Engage in battle. That philosophy of action had always worked for him. It would work again. This window looked out from the back of the motel, across the vast meadows and hills of the uninhabited uplands, and the only light out there was what fell from the stars. He must pull the drapes aside. Come face to face with that tenebrous landscape. Stand fast. Endure it. Confrontation would be a purgative, flushing the poison from his system. Ernie pulled open the drapes. He peered out at the night and told himself that this perfect blackness was not so bad. Deep and pure, vast and cold, but not malevolent, and in no way a personal threat. However, as he watched, unmoving and unmovable, portions of the darkness seemed to, well, to shift, to coalesce, forming into not quite visible but nonetheless solid shapes, lumps of pulsing and denser blackness within the greater blackness, lurking phantoms that at any moment might launch themselves toward the fragile window. He clenched his jaws, put his forehead against the ice-cold glass. The Nevada Barrens, a huge emptiness to begin with, now seemed to expand even farther. He could not see the night-cloaked mountains, but he sensed that they were magically receding, that the plains between him and the mountains were growing larger, extending outward hundreds of miles, thousands, expanding swiftly toward infinity until suddenly he was at the center of a void so immense that it defied description. On all sides of him, there was emptiness and lightlessness beyond man's ability to measure, beyond the limits of his own feeble imagination, a terrible emptiness to the left and right, front and back, above and below, and suddenly he could not breathe. This was considerably worse than anything he had known before. A deeper reaching fear. Profound. Shocking in its power. And it was in total control of him. Abruptly, he was aware of all the weight of that enormous darkness, and it seemed to be sliding inexorably in upon him, sliding and sliding, incalculably high walls of heavy darkness, collapsing, pressing down, squeezing the breath out of him. He screamed and threw himself back from the window. He fell to his knees as the drapes dropped into place with a soft rustle. The window was hidden again. The darkness was concealed. All around him was light. Blessed light. He hung his head, shuddered, and took great gulps of air. He crawled to the bed and hoisted himself onto the mattress, where he lay for a long time, listening to his heartbeat, which was like footfalls, sprinting, then running, then just walking fast inside him. Instead of solving his problem, bold confrontation had made it worse.
"What's happening here?"
he said aloud, staring at the ceiling.
"What's wrong with me? Dear God, what's wrong with me?"
It was November 22nd. 4. Laguna Beach, California. Saturday, in desperate reaction to yet another troubling episode of somnambulism, Dom Corvaces thoroughly, methodically exhausted himself. By nightfall, he intended to be so wrung out that he'd sleep as still as a stone, locked immemorially in the bosom of the earth. At 7 o'clock in the morning, With the night's cool mist lingering in the canyons and bearding the trees, he performed half an hour of vigorous calisthenics on the patio overlooking the ocean, then put on his running shoes and did 7 arduous miles on Laguna's sloped streets. He spent the next 5 hours doing heavy gardening. Then, because it was a warm day, he put on his swimsuit, put towels in his Firebird, and went to the beach. He sunbathed a little and swam a lot. After dinner at Picasso's, he walked for another hour along shop-lined streets sparsely populated by off-season tourists. At last, he drove home. Undressing in his bedroom, Dom felt as if he were in the land of Lilliput, where 1,000 tiny people were pulling him down with grappling lines. He rarely drank, but now he tossed back a shot of Remy Martin. In bed, he fell asleep even as he clicked off the lamp. The incidents of somnambulism were growing more frequent, and the problem was now the central issue of his life. It was interfering with his work. The new book, which had been going well, it contained the best writing he had ever done, was stalled. In the past 2 weeks, he had awakened in a closet on 9 occasions, 4 times in the last 4 nights. The affliction had ceased to be amusing and intriguing. He was afraid to go to sleep because, asleep, he was not in control of himself. Yesterday, Friday, he had finally gone to his physician, Dr. Paul Koblets in Newport Beach. Haltingly, he told Koblets all about his sleepwalking, but he found himself unwilling and unable to express the true depth and seriousness of his concern. Dom had always been a very private person, made so by a childhood spent in 12 foster homes and under the care of surrogate parents, some of whom were indifferent or even hostile, all of whom were dismayingly temporary presences in his life. He was reluctant to share his most important and personal thoughts except through the mouths of imaginary characters in his fiction. As a result, Koblets was not unduly worried. After a full physical examination, he pronounced Dom exceptionally fit. He attributed the somnambulism to stress, to the upcoming publication of the novel.
"You don't think we should do any tests?" Dom asked.
Koblets said, "You're a writer, so of course your imagination is running away with you. Brain tumor, you're thinking, am I right?"
"Well, yes."
"Any headaches? Dizziness? Blurred vision?"
"No."
"I've examined your eyes. There's no change in your retinas. No indication of intracranial pressure. Any inexplicable vomiting?"
"No, nothing like that."
"Giddy spells? Giggling or periods of euphoria without apparent reason? Anything of that nature?"
"No."
"Then I see no reason for tests at this stage."
"Do you think I need psychotherapy?"
"Good heavens, no! I'm sure this will pass soon."
Finished dressing, Dom watched Koblets close the file. He said,
"I thought perhaps sleeping pills."
No, Koblets said, "not yet. I don't believe in drugs as a treatment of first resort. Here's what you do, Dom. Get away from the writing for a few weeks. Don't do anything cerebral. Get plenty of physical exercise. Go to bed tired every night, so tired that you can't even bother to think about the book you've been working on. A few days of that and you'll be cured. I'm convinced of it."
Saturday, Dom began the treatment Dr. Koblets prescribed, devoting himself to physical activity, though with more single-mindedness and flagellant persistence than the doctor had suggested. Consequently, he plummeted into a deep sleep the moment he put his head upon the pillow, and in the morning, he did not wake in a closet. He did not wake in bed, either. This time he was in the garage. He regained consciousness in a breathless state of terror, gasping, his heart hammering so hard it seemed capable of shattering his ribs with its furious blows. His mouth was dry, his hands curled into fists. He was cramped and sore, partly from Saturday's excess of exercise, but partly from the unnatural and uncomfortable position in which he had been sleeping. During the night, He evidently had taken two folded canvas drop cloths from a shelf above the workbench and had squirreled into a narrow service space behind the furnace. That was where he lay now, concealed beneath the tarps. Concealed was the right word. He had not dragged the tarpaulins over himself merely for warmth. He had taken refuge behind the furnace and beneath the canvas because he had been hiding from something. From what? Even now, as Dominic pushed the tarps aside and struggled to sit up, as sleep receded, and as his bleary eyes adjusted to the shadow-filled garage, the intense anxiety that had accompanied him up from sleep still clung tenaciously. His pulse pounded. Fear of what? Dreaming. In his nightmare, he must have been running and hiding from some monster. Yes, of course. His peril in the nightmare caused him to sleepwalk, and when, in the dream, he sought a place to hide, he also hid in reality, creeping behind the furnace. His white firebird loomed ghost-like in the vague light from the wall vents and the single window above the workbench. Shuffling across the garage, he felt as if he were a revenant himself. In the house, he went directly to his office. Morning light filled the room, making him squint. He sat at the desk in his filthy pajama bottoms, switched on the word processor, and studied the documents on the diskette that he had left in the machine. The diskette was as he had left it on Thursday. It contained no new material. Dom had hoped that, in his sleep, he might have left a message that would help him understand the source of his anxiety. That knowledge was obviously held by his subconscious, but thus far denied to his conscious mind. When sleepwalking, his subconscious was in control, and possibly it would try to explain things to his conscious mind by way of the display writer. But as yet it had not. He switched off the machine. He sat for a long time, staring out the window toward the ocean, wondering. Later, in the bedroom, as he was on his way to the master bath, he found something strange. Nails were scattered across the carpet, and he had to be careful where he walked. He stooped, picked up several of them. They were all alike. 1.5-inch steel finishing nails. At the far side of the room, he saw two objects that drew him there. Beneath the window, from which the drapes had been drawn aside, a box of nails lay on the floor by the baseboard. It was only half full because part of its contents had spilled from it. Beside the box was a hammer. He lifted the hammer, hefted it, frowned. What had he been doing in those lonely hours of the night? He raised his eyes to the windowsill and saw three loose nails that he had laid there. They gleamed in the sunlight. Judging from the evidence, he'd been preparing to nail the windows shut. Jesus! Something had so frightened him that he had intended to nail the windows shut and make a fortress of his house. But before he could set himself to the task, he had been suddenly overwhelmed by fear and had fled to the garage where he had hidden behind the furnace. He dropped the hammer, stood, looked out the window. Beyond lay only bloom-laden rose bushes, a small strip of lawn, and an ivy-covered slope that led up to another house. A lovely landscape. Peaceful. He could not believe that it had been any different last night, that something more threatening had been crouching out there in the darkness. And yet... For a while Dom Corvaces watched the day grow brighter, watched the bees visit the roses, then began to pick up the nails. It was November 24th. Five. Boston, Massachusetts. After the incident of the black gloves, 2 weeks passed without another attack. For a few days following the embarrassing scene at Bernstein's Delicatessen, Ginger Weiss remained on edge, expecting another seizure. She was unusually self-aware, acutely conscious of her physiological and psychological conditions, searching for subtle symptoms of serious disorder, alert for the slightest sign of another impending fugue. But she noticed nothing worrisome. She had no headaches, no attacks of nausea, no joint or muscle pain. Gradually, her confidence rose to its usual high level. She became convinced that her wild flight had been entirely stress-related, a never-to-be-repeated aberration. Her days at Memorial were busier than ever. George Hanaby, chief of surgery, a tall, burly bear of a man who talked slow, walked slow, and looked deceptively lazy, maintained a heavy schedule, and though Ginger was not the only resident working under him, she was the only one who currently worked exclusively with him. She assisted in many, perhaps in a majority of his procedures, aortal grafts, amputations, popliteal bypasses, embolectomies, portocaval shunts, thoracotomies, arteriograms, the installation of temporary and permanent pacemakers, and more. George observed her every move, was quick to note the slightest flaw in her skill and techniques. Although he looked like a friendly bear, he was a tough taskmaster and had no patience for laziness, ineptitude, or carelessness. He could be scathing in his critiques, and he made all the young doctors sweat. His scorn was not merely withering, it was dehydrating, searing, a nuclear heat. Some residents considered George tyrannical, but Ginger enjoyed assisting him precisely because his standards were so high. She knew that his criticisms, though sometimes blisteringly delivered, were motivated solely by his concern for the patient, and she never took them personally. When she finally earned Hanaby's unqualified blessing, well, that would be almost as good as God's own seal of approval. On the last Monday in November, 13 days after her strange seizure, Ginger assisted in a triple bypass heart operation on Johnny O'Day, a 53-year-old Boston police officer who had been forced into early retirement by cardiovascular disease. Johnny was stocky, rubber-faced, tousle-haired, with merry blue eyes, unassuming, quick to laugh in spite of his troubles. Ginger was especially drawn to him because, although he looked nothing whatsoever like the late Jacob Weiss, he nevertheless reminded her of her father. She was afraid Johnny O'Day was going to die, and that it was going to be, in part, her fault. She had no reason to believe that he was more vulnerable than other cardiac patients. In fact, Johnny was in comparatively little danger. He was 10 years younger than the average recipient of bypass surgery, with greater resources for recuperation. His cardiac ailment was not complicated by any other debilitating conditions, such as phlebitis or excessively high blood pressure. His prospects were encouraging. But Ginger could not twist free of the dread in which she found herself increasingly tangled. On Monday afternoon, as the hour of surgery drew near, she grew tense and her stomach turned sour. For the first time since she had sat a lonely vigil beside her father's hospital bed and had helplessly watched him die, Ginger was filled with doubt. Perhaps her apprehension grew from the unjustified but inescapable notion that if she somehow failed this patient, she would in a sense be failing Jacob yet again. Or perhaps her fear was utterly unwarranted and would seem foolish and laughable in hindsight. Perhaps. Nevertheless, entering the operating theater at George's side, she wondered if her hands would shake. A surgeon's hands must never shake. The operating room was all white and aqua tile, filled with gleaming, chrome-plated and stainless steel equipment. Nurses and an anesthesiologist were preparing the patient. Johnny O'Day lay on the cruciform operating table, arms extended, palms up, and wrists exposed for the intravenous spikes. Agatha Tandy, a private surgical technician who was employed by George rather than by the hospital, stretched thin latex gloves over her boss's freshly scrubbed hands, then over Ginger's hands as well. The patient had been anesthetized. He was orange with iodine from the neck to the wrist, swathed in neatly tucked and folded layers of green cloth from the hips down. His eyes were taped shut to keep them from drying out. His breathing was slow but regular. A portable tape deck with stereo speakers was on a stool in one corner. George preferred to cut to the accompaniment of Bach, and that calming music now filled the room. It may have calmed the others, but today it did not calm Ginger. A secret, scurrying something spun a web of ice in her stomach. Hanabe positioned himself at the table. Agatha stood at his right side with an elaborately ordered tray of instruments. The circulating nurse waited to fetch whatever might be required from the cabinets along one wall. An assisting nurse with large gray eyes noticed an errant flap of green sheeting and quickly tucked it into place around the patient's body. The anesthesiologist and his nurse were at the head of the table, monitoring the IV and the EKG. Ginger moved into position. The team was ready. Ginger looked at her hands. They were not shaking. Inside, though, she was all a quiver. In spite of her sense of impending disaster, the surgery went smoothly. George Hanabe operated with quickness, sureness, dexterity, and skill that were even more impressive than usual. Twice, he stepped aside and requested that Ginger complete a part of the procedure. Ginger surprised herself by functioning with her customary sureness and speed, her fear and tension revealed only by a tendency to perspire more than usual. However, the nurse was always there to blot her brow. Afterward, at the scrub, St. George said, "Like clockwork." Soaping her hands under the hot water, she said,
"You always seem so relaxed, as if you weren't a surgeon at all, as if you were just a tailor altering a suit of clothes."
"I may seem that way, but I'm always tense. That's why I play Bach."
He finished washing up.
"You were very tense today."
"Yes," she admitted.
"Exceptionally tense. It happens."
Big as he was, he sometimes seemed to have the eyes of a sweet, gentle child.
"The important thing is that it didn't affect your skill. You were as smooth as ever. First rate. That's the key. You've got to use tension to your advantage."
"I guess I'm learning," he grinned.
"As usual, you're being too hard on yourself. I'm proud of you, kid. For a while there, I thought maybe you'd have to give up medicine and earn your living as a meat cutter in a supermarket. But now, I know you'll make it."
She grinned back at him, but the grin was counterfeit. She had been more than tense. She had been seized by a cold, black fear that might easily have overwhelmed her, and that was much different from a healthy tension. That fear was something she had never felt before, something that she knew George Hanabe had never felt in his life, not in an operating room. If it continued, if the fear became a constant companion during surgery and would not be dispelled, what then? At 10:30 that evening, when she was reading in bed, the phone rang. It was George Hanabe. If the call had come earlier, she'd have panicked and assumed that Johnny O'Day had taken a serious turn for the worse. But now she had regained her perspective.
"So sorry, Missy Wise not home. I no speak the English. Call back next April, please."
"If that's supposed to be a Spanish accent," George said, "it's atrocious. If it's supposed to be Oriental, it's merely terrible. Be thankful you chose medicine as a career instead of acting."
"You, on the other hand, would have done well as a drama critic."
"I do have the refined and sensitive perspective, the cool judgment and unerring insight of a first-rate critic, don't I? Now shut up and listen. I've got good news. I think you're ready, smartass."
"Ready? For what?"
"The big time.
an aortal graft.
You mean I wouldn't just assist you? Do it entirely myself?
Chief Surgeon for the entire procedure.
Aortal graft?
Sure. You didn't specialize in cardiovascular surgery just to perform appendectomies for the rest of your life.
She was sitting straight up in bed now. Her heart was beating faster, and she was flushed with excitement.
When?
Next week. There's a patient checking in this Thursday or Friday. Name's Fletcher. We'll go over her file together on Wednesday. If things proceed according to schedule, I would think we'd be ready to cut on Monday morning. Of course, you'll be responsible for scheduling all the final tests and making the decision to go ahead.
Oh, God.
You'll do fine.
You'll be with me.
I'll assist you, if you feel you need me for anything.
And you'll take over if I start to screw up?
Don't be silly. You won't screw up.
She thought about it a moment, then said,
No. I won't screw up.
That's my ginger. You can do whatever you set your mind to.
Even ride a giraffe to the moon.
What?
Private joke.
Listen, I know you came close to panic this afternoon, but don't worry. All residents experience that. Most have to deal with it early when they begin to assist in the surgery. They call it the clutch. But you've been cool and collected from the start, and I had finally decided you'd never clutch up like the rest of them. Today, at last, you did. The clutch just came later for you than for most, and though I imagine you're still worried about it, I think you should be glad it happened. The clutch is a seasoning experience. The important thing is that you dealt with it superbly.
Thanks, George. Even better than a drama critic, you'd have made a good baseball coach.
Minutes later, when they concluded their conversation and hung up, she fell back against the pillows again and hugged herself and felt so fine that she actually giggled. After a while, she went to the closet and dug around in there until she located the Weiss family photograph album. She brought it back to bed and sat for a time, paging through the pictures of Jacob and Anna, for although she could not share her triumphs with them anymore, she needed to feel that they were close. Later still, in the dark bedroom, as she lay balanced on the thin edge of wakefulness, she finally understood why she had been frightened this afternoon. She had not been seized by the clutch. Although she had not been able to admit it until now, she had been afraid that, in the midst of surgery, she would black out, plummet into a state of fugue as she had done that Tuesday 2 weeks ago. If an attack came while she held a scalpel, while she was doing delicate cutting, or while stitching in a vascular graft. That thought brought her eyes wide open. The creeping form of sleep retreated like a thief caught in the middle of a burglary. For a long time she lay there, stiff, staring at the dark and newly ominous shapes of the bedroom furniture and at the window, where incompletely drawn draperies revealed a band of glass silvered by a fall of moonlight and by the rising beams of street lamps below. Could she accept the responsibility of chief surgeon on an aortal graft? Her seizure had surely been a one-time occurrence. It would never happen again, surely not. But did she dare test that theory? Sleep crept back again and claimed her, though not for hours. Tuesday, after a successful trip to Bernstein's delicatessen, much food, and several lazy hours in an easy chair with a good book, her self-confidence was knit up again, and she began to look forward to the challenge ahead with only an ordinary degree and kind of apprehension. On Wednesday, Johnny O'Day continued to recover from his triple bypass and was in high spirits. This was what made the years of study and hard work worthwhile, preserving life, relieving suffering, bringing hope and happiness to those who had known despair. She assisted in a pacemaker implantation that went without a hitch, and she performed an aortogram, a dye test on a patient's circulation. She also sat in with George while he examined seven people who had been referred to him by other physicians. When all the new patients had been seen, George and Ginger huddled for half an hour over the file of the candidate for the aortal graft, a 58-year-old woman, Viola Fletcher. After studying the file, Ginger decided she wanted Mrs. Fletcher admitted to Memorial on Thursday for testing and preparation. If there were no counterindications, surgery could take place first thing Monday morning. George agreed, and all the necessary arrangements were made. Thus, Wednesday progressed, always busy, never dull. By 6:30 she had put in a 12-hour day, but she was not tired. In fact, although she had nothing to keep her at the hospital, she was reluctant to leave. George Hannaby was home already, but Ginger hung around, chatting with patients, double-checking charts, until at last she went to George's office, where she intended to look again at Viola Fletcher's file. The professional offices were in the back wing of the building, separate from the hospital itself. At that hour, the corridors were virtually deserted. Ginger's rubber-soled shoes squeaked on the highly polished tile floors. The air smelled of pine-scented disinfectant. George Hannaby's waiting room, examining rooms, and private office were dark and quiet, and Ginger did not switch on all the lights as she moved through the outer rooms into the inner sanctum. There, she snapped on only the desk lamp as she passed it on her way to the file room door, which was locked. George had given her keys to everything, and in a minute she had withdrawn Viola Fletcher's records from the cabinet and returned with them to George's desk. She sat down in the big leather chair, opened the folder in the pool of light from the desk lamp, and only then noticed an object that riveted her attention and caused her breath to catch in her throat. It lay on the green blotter, along the curvature of light. A handheld ophthalmoscope, an instrument used to examine the interior of the eye. There was nothing unusual, certainly nothing ominous about the ophthalmoscope. Every doctor used such an instrument during a routine physical examination, yet the sight of this one not only inhibited her breathing, but filled her with a sudden sense of terrible danger. She had broken out in a cold sweat. Her heart was hammering so hard, so loud, that the sound of it seemed to come not from within but without, as if a parade drum was thumping in the street beyond the window. She could not take her eyes off the ophthalmoscope. As with the black gloves in Bernstein's delicatessen more than 2 weeks ago, all other objects in George's office began to fade, until the shining instrument was the only thing that she could see in any detail. She was aware of every tiny scratch and minute nick on its handle. Every humble feature of its design seemed abruptly and enormously important, as if this were not a doctor's ordinary tool but the linchpin of the universe. An arcane instrument with the potential for catastrophic destruction. Disoriented, suddenly made claustrophobic by a heavy, insistent, pressing mantle of irrational fear that had descended over her like a great sodden cloak, she pushed the chair away from the desk and stood up. Gasping, whimpering, she felt suffocated, yet chilled to the bone at the same time. The shank of the ophthalmoscope glistened as if made of ice. The lens shone like an iridescent and chillingly alien eye. Her resolve to stand fast now swiftly melted, even as her heart seemed to freeze under the cold breath of terror. "Run or die," a voice said within her. "Run or die." A cry escaped her, and it sounded like the tortured appeal of a lost and frightened child. She turned from the desk, stumbled around it, almost fell over a chair. She crossed the room, burst into the outer office, fled into the deserted corridor, keening shrilly, seeking safety, finding none. She wanted help, a friendly face, but she was the only person on the floor, and the danger was closing in. The unknown threat that was somehow embodied in the harmless ophthalmoscope was drawing nearer. So she ran as fast as she could,
her footsteps booming along the hallway. Run or die! The mist descended. Minutes later, when the mist cleared, when she was again aware of her surroundings, she found herself in the emergency stairwell at the end of the office wing, on a concrete landing between floors. She could not remember leaving the office corridor and taking to the stairs. She was sitting on the landing, squeezed into the corner, her back pressed to the cinder block wall, staring out at the railing along the far side of the steps. A single bare bulb burned behind a wire basket overhead. To her left and right, flights of stairs led up and down into shadow before coming to other lighted landings. The air was musty and cool. If not for her ragged breathing, silence would have ruled. It was a lonely place, especially when your life was coming apart at the seams, and you needed the reassurance of bright lights and people. The gray walls, stark, light, looming shadows, the metal railing, the place seemed like a reflection of her own despair. Her wild flight, and whatever other bizarre behavior she exhibited in her inexplicable fugue, had evidently not been seen, or she would not now be alone. At least that was a blessing. At least no one knew. She knew, however, and that was bad enough. She shivered, not entirely from fear, for the mindless terror that had gripped her was gone. She shivered because she was cold, and she was cold because her clothes clung to her, damp, soaked with sweat. She raised one hand, wiped her face. She rose, looked up the stairwell, then down. She did not know whether she was above or below the floor on which George Hannaby had his office. After a moment, she decided to go up. Her footsteps echoed eerily. For some reason, she thought of tombs. "Meshuggah," she said shakily. It was November 27th. Six. Chicago, Illinois. The first Sunday morning in December was cold, under a low, gray sky that promised snow. By afternoon, the first scattered flakes would begin to fall, and by early evening, the city's grimy face and soiled skirts would be temporarily concealed beneath the white pancake makeup and pristine cloak of snow. This night, from the Gold Coast to the slum tenements, everywhere in the city, the number one topic of conversation would be the storm. Everywhere, that is, but in the Roman Catholic homes throughout the parish of St. Bernadette's, where they would still be talking about the shocking thing Father Brendan Cronin had done during the early Mass that morning. Father Cronin rose at 5:30 a.m., said prayers, showered, shaved, dressed in cassock and beretta, picked up his breviary, and left the parish house without bothering to put on a coat. He stood for a moment on the rear porch, breathing deeply of the crisp December air. He was 30 years old, but with his direct green eyes and unruly auburn hair and freckled face, he looked younger than he was. He was 50 or 60 pounds overweight, though not particularly thick in the middle. On him, fat distributed evenly, filling him out equally in face, arms, torso, and legs. From childhood through college until his second year at the seminary, his nickname had been Pudge. Regardless of his emotional state, Father Cronin nearly always looked happy. His face had a natural cherubic aspect, and the round lines of it were not designed for the clear and easy expression of anger, melancholy, or grief. This morning he looked mildly pleased with himself and with the world, though he was deeply troubled. He followed a flagstone path across the yard, past denuded flower beds where the bare earth lay in frozen clumps. He unlocked the door of the sacristy and let himself in. Myrrh and spikenard blended with the scent of the lemon oil furniture polish with which the old church's oak paneling, pews, and other wooden objects were anointed. Without switching on the lights, with only the
flickering ruby glow of the sacristy lamp to guide him, Father Cronin knelt at the prie-dieu and bowed his head. In silence, he petitioned the Divine Father to make him a worthy priest. In the past, this private devotion, before the arrival of the sexton and the altar boy, had sent his spirits soaring, and had filled him with exultation at the prospect of celebrating Mass. But now, as on most other mornings during the last 4 months, joy eluded him. He felt only a leaden bleakness, an emptiness that made his heart ache dully, and that induced a cold, sick trembling in his belly. Clenching his jaws, gritting his teeth, as if he could will himself into a state of spiritual ecstasy, he repeated his petition, elaborated upon his initial prayers, but still he felt unmoved, hollow. After washing his hands and murmuring, "Da Domine," Father Cronin laid his beretta on the prie-dieu and went to the vesting bench to attire himself for the sacred celebration ahead. He was a sensitive man with an artist's soul, and in the great beauty of the ceremony he perceived a pleasing pattern of divine order, a subtle echo of God's grace. Usually, when placing the linen amice over his shoulders, when arranging the white alb so that it fell evenly to his ankles, a shiver of awe passed through him, awe that he, Brendan Cronin, should have achieved this sacred office. Usually, but not today, and not for weeks of days before this. Father Cronin put on his amice, passed the strings around his back, then tied them against his breast. He pulled on the alb with no more emotion than a welder getting dressed for work in a factory. 4 months ago, in early August, Father Brendan Cronin had begun to lose his faith. A small but relentless fire of doubt burned within him, unquenchable, gradually consuming all of his long-held beliefs. For any priest, the loss of faith is a devastating process. But it was worse for Brendan Cronin than it would have been for most others. He had never even briefly entertained the thought of being anything but a priest. His parents were devout, and they fostered in him a devotion to the church. However, he had not become a priest to please them. Simply, as trite as it might sound to others in this age of agnosticism, he had been called to the priesthood at a very young age. Now, though faith was gone, his holy office continued to be the essential part of his self-image. Yet he knew he could not go on saying Mass and praying and comforting the afflicted when it was nothing but a charade to him. Brendan Cronin placed the stole around his neck. As he pulled on the chasuble, the courtyard door to the sacristy was flung open, and a young boy burst into the room, switching on the electric lights that the priest had preferred to do without.
"Morning, Father."
"Morning, Carrie. How are you this fine morning?"
Except that his hair was much redder than Father Cronin's, Carrie McDevitt might have been the priest's blood relative. He was slightly plump, freckled, with green eyes full of mischief.
"I'm fine, Father. But it's sure cold out there this morning. Cold as a witch's..."
"Huh? Yes?
Cold as a, witch's what?" "Refrigerator,"
the boy said, embarrassed.
"Cold as a witch's refrigerator, Father. And that's cold."
If his mood had not been so bleak, Brendan would have been amused by the boy's narrow avoidance of an innocent obscenity. But in his current state of mind, he could not summon even a shadow of a smile. Undoubtedly, his silence was interpreted as stern disapproval, for Carrie averted his eyes and went quickly to the closet, where he stowed his coat, scarf, and gloves, and took his cassock and surplice from a hanger. Even as Brendan lifted the maniple, kissed the cross in its center, and placed it on his left forearm, he felt nothing. There was just that cold, throbbing, hollow ache where belief and joy had once existed. As his hands were occupied with that task, his mind drifted back to a melancholy recollection of the exuberance with which he had once approached every priestly duty. Until last August, he never doubted the wisdom of his commitment to the church. He had been such a bright and hard-working student of both mundane subjects and religion that he had been chosen to complete his Catholic education at the North American College in Rome. He loved the Holy City, the architecture, the history, and the friendly people. Upon ordination and acceptance into the Society of Jesus, he had spent 2 years at the Vatican as an assistant to Monsignor Giuseppe Orbella, chief speechwriter and doctrinal advisor to His Holiness the Pope. That honor could have been followed by a prized assignment to the staff of the Cardinal of the Chicago Archdiocese, but Father Cronin had requested instead a curacy at a small or medium-sized parish, like any young priest. Thus, after a visit to Bishop Santafiore in San Francisco, an old friend of Monsignor Orbella's, and after a vacation during which he drove from San Francisco to Chicago, he had come to St. Bernadette's, where he had taken great pleasure in even the most ordinary day-to-day chores of a curate's life, and with never a regret or doubt. Now, as he watched his altar boy slip into his surplice, Father Cronin longed for the simple faith that had for so long comforted and sustained him. Was it gone only temporarily, or had he lost it forever? When Carey was dressed, he led the way through the inner sacristy door into the sanctuary of the church. Several steps beyond the door, he evidently sensed that Father Cronin was not coming after him, for he glanced back, a puzzled look upon his face. Brendan Cronin hesitated. Through the door, he had a side view of the towering crucifix on the back wall and the altar platform straight ahead. This holiest part of the church was dismayingly strange, as if he were seeing it objectively for the first time, and he could not imagine why he had ever thought of it as sacred territory. It was just a place like any other. If he walked out there now, if he went through the familiar rituals and litanies, he would be a hypocrite. He would be defrauding everyone in the congregation. The puzzlement on Carrie McDevitt's face had turned to worry. The boy glanced out toward the pews that Brendan Cronin could not see, then looked again at his priest. "How can I say Mass when I no longer believe?" Brendan wondered. But there was nothing else to be done. Holding the chalice in his left hand, with his right hand over the burse and veil, he kept the sacred vessel close to his breast and followed Carey, at last, into the sanctuary, where the face of Christ upon the cross seemed, for a moment, to gaze at him accusingly. As usual, less than 100 people were in attendance for the early service. Their faces were unusually pale and radiant, as if God had not allowed real worshippers to attend this morning, but had sent a deputation of judgmental angels to witness the sacrilege of a doubting priest who dared to offer Mass in spite of his fallen condition. As the Mass progressed, Father Cronin's despair deepened. From the moment he spoke the Introibo ad Altare Dei, each step of the ceremony compounded the priest's misery. By the time Carey McDevitt transferred the missal from the epistle to the gospel side of the altar, Father Cronin's despondency was so heavy that he felt crushed beneath it. His spiritual and emotional exhaustion were so profound that he could barely lift his arms, could hardly find strength to focus on the gospel and mutter the lines from the sacred text. The faces of the worshippers blurred into featureless blobs. By the time he reached the canon of the Mass, Father Cronin could barely whisper. He knew that Carey was gaping at him openly now, and he was sure that the congregation was aware that something was wrong. He was sweating and shaking. The awful Grayness in him grew darker now, swiftly turning to black, and he felt as if he were spiraling down into a frighteningly dark void. Then, as he held the host in his hands and elevated it, speaking the five words that signified the mystery of transubstantiation, he was suddenly angry with himself for being unable to believe, angry with the church for failing to provide him with better armor against doubt, angry that his entire life seemed misdirected, wasted, expended in pursuit of idiotic myths. His anger churned, heated up, reached the boiling point, was transformed into a steam of fury, a blistering vapor of rage. To his astonishment, a wretched cry burst from him, and he pitched the chalice across the sanctuary. With a loud clank, it struck the sanctuary wall, spraying wine, rebounded, bounced off a statue of the Blessed Virgin, and clattered to a stop against the foot of the podium at which he had not long ago read from the Gospels. Kerry McDevitt stumbled back in shock, and in the nave, 100 people gasped as one. But that response had no effect on Brendan Cronin. In a rage that was his only protection against suicidal despair, he flung one arm wide and swept a paten of communion wafers to the floor. With another wild cry, half anger and half grief, he thrust his hand under his chasuble, tore off the stole that lay around his neck and threw it down, turned from the altar and raced into the sacristy. There, the anger departed, as suddenly as it had come, and he stopped and stood there, swaying in confusion. It was December 1st. 7. Laguna Beach, California. That first Sunday in December, Dom Corvaces had lunch with Parker Fane on the terrace at Las Brisas, in the shade of an umbrella table overlooking the sun-dappled sea. The good weather was holding well this year. While the breeze brought them the cries of gulls, the tang of the sea, and the sweet scent of star jasmine that was growing nearby, Dominic told Parker every embarrassing and distressing detail of his escalating battle with somnambulism. Parker Fane was his best friend, perhaps the only person in the world with whom he could open up like this, though on the surface they seemed to have little in common. Dom was a slender, lean-muscled man, but Parker Fane was squat, burly, beefy. Beardless, Dom went to the barber for a haircut every 3 weeks, but Parker's hair was shaggy, and his beard was shaggy, and his eyebrows bristled. He looked like a cross between a professional wrestler and a beatnik from the 1950s. Dom drank little and was easily intoxicated, while Parker's thirst was legendary and his capacity prodigious. Although Dom was solitary by nature and slow to make friends, Parker had the gift of seeming like an old acquaintance just an hour after you first met him. At 50, Parker Fane was 15 years older than Dom. He had been rich and famous for almost a quarter of a century, and he was comfortable with both his wealth and fame, utterly unable to understand Dom's uneasiness over the money and notoriety that was beginning to come his way because of Twilight in Babylon. Dom had come to lunch at Las Brisas in bally loafers, dark brown slacks, and a lighter brown checkered shirt with a button-down collar. But Parker had arrived in blue tennis shoes, heavily crinkled white cotton pants, and a white and blue flowered shirt worn over his belt, which made it seem as if they had dressed for entirely different engagements, had met outside the restaurant sheerly by chance, and had decided to have lunch together on a whim. In spite of all the ways they differed from each other, they had become fast friends, because in several important ways they were alike. Both were artists, not by choice or inclination, but by compulsion. Dom painted with words, Parker painted with paint, and they approached their different arts with identical high standards, commitment, craftsmanship. Furthermore, Though Parker made friends more easily than Dom did, each placed enormous value on friendship and nurtured it. They had met 6 years ago when Parker had moved to Oregon for 18 months in search of new subject matter for a series of landscapes done in his unique style, which successfully married supra-realism with a surreal imagination. While there, he had signed to give one lecture a month at the University of Portland, where Dom held a position in the Department of English. Now, while Parker hunched over the table, munching on nachos that were dripping with cheese and guacamole and sour cream, Dom sipped slowly at a bottle of Negra Modelo and recounted his unconscious nocturnal adventures. He spoke softly, though discretion was probably unnecessary. The other diners on the terrace were noisily involved in their own conversations. He did not touch the nachos. This morning, for the fourth time, he had awakened behind the furnace in the garage, in a state of undiluted terror, and his continued inability to get control of himself had left him dispirited and without an appetite. By the time he finished his tale, he had drunk only half the beer, for even that rich, dark Mexican brew tasted flat and stale today. Parker, on the other hand, had poured down 3 double-shot margaritas and already ordered a fourth. However, the painter's attention was not dulled by the alcohol he consumed.
"Jesus, buddy, why didn't you tell me about this sooner, weeks ago?"
"I felt sort of foolish."
"Nonsense. Bullshit," the painter insisted, gesturing expansively with one huge hand but keeping his voice low.
The Mexican waiter, a diminutive Wayne Newton look-alike, arrived with Parker's margarita and inquired if they wished to order lunch.
"No, no. Sunday lunch is an excuse to have too many margaritas, and I'm a long way from having too many. What a sad waste to order lunch after only 4 margaritas. That'd leave most of the afternoon unfilled, and we'd find ourselves on the street with nothing to occupy us. And then, without doubt, we'd get into trouble, attract the attention of the police. God knows what might happen. Now, to avoid jail and protect our reputations, we must not order lunch sooner than 3 o'clock. In fact, bring me another margarita and another order of these magnificent nachos, please. More salsa. Hotter if you've got it. A dish of chopped onions, too, please, and another beer for my dismayingly restrained friend.
No, Dom said. I'm only half finished with this one.
That's what I meant by dismayingly restrained, you hopeless Puritan. You've sucked at that one so long it must be warm.
Ordinarily, Dominic would have leaned back and enjoyed Parker Fane's energetic performance. The painter's ebullience, his unfailing enthusiasm for life, was invigorating and amusing. Today, however, Dom was so troubled that he was not amused. As the waiter turned away, a small cloud passed over the sun, and Parker leaned in farther under the suddenly deeper shadow beneath the umbrella, returning his attention to Dominic as if he had read his companion's mind.
"All right, let's brainstorm. Let's find some sort of explanation and figure out what to do. You don't think the problem is just related to stress? The upcoming publication of your book?"
"I did, but not anymore. I mean, if the problem was just a mild one, I might be able to accept that career worries lay behind it. But, Jesus, my concerns about Twilight just aren't great enough to generate behavior this unusual, this obsessive, this crazy. I go walking almost every night now, and it's not just the walking that's weird. The depth of my trance is incredible. Few sleepwalkers are as utterly comatose as I am, and few of them engage in such elaborate tasks as I do. I mean, I was attempting to nail the windows shut. And you don't attempt to nail your windows shut just to keep out your worries about your career.
You may be more deeply worried about Twilight than you realize."
"No, it doesn't make sense. In fact, when the new book continued to go well, my anxiety about Twilight started fading. You can't sit there and honestly tell me you think all this middle-of-the-night lunacy springs just from a few career worries."
"Nah, I can't," Parker agreed. I crawl into the backs of those closets to hide. And when I wake up behind the furnace, when I'm still half asleep, I have the feeling that something's stalking me, searching for me, something that'll kill me if it finds my hidey hole. A couple of mornings, I woke up trying to scream but unable to get it out. Yesterday, I woke up shouting, "Stay away! Stay away! Stay away!" And this morning, the knife...
"Knife?" Parker said. "You didn't tell me about a knife."
"Woke up behind the furnace, hiding again. Had a butcher's knife. I'd removed it from the rack in the kitchen while I was sleeping."
"For protection? From what?"
"From whatever... from whoever's stalking me."
"And who is stalking you?"
Dom shrugged.
"Nobody
that I'm aware of."
"I don't like this. You could have cut yourself, maybe badly."
"That's not what scares me the most."
"So what scares you the most?"
Dom looked around at the other people on the terrace. Though some had followed Parker Fane's bit of theater with the waiter, no one was now paying the least attention to him or Dominic.
"What scares you the most?" Parker repeated.
"That I might cut someone else."
Incredulous, Fane said,
"You mean take a butcher's knife and go on a murdering rampage in your sleep?"
"No chance."
He gulped his margarita.
"Good heavens, what a melodramatic notion. Thankfully, your fiction is not quite so sloppily imagined. Relax, my friend, you're not the homicidal type."
"I didn't think I was the sleepwalking type either."
"Oh, bullshit. There's an explanation for this. You're not mad. Madmen never doubt their sanity."
"I think I'm going to have to see a psychiatrist, a counselor of some kind, and have a few medical tests."
"The medical tests, yes, but put a hold on the psychiatrist. That's a waste of time. You're no more neurotic than psychotic."
The waiter returned with more nachos, salsa, a dish of chopped onions, a beer, and a fifth margarita. Parker surrendered his empty glass, took the full one. He scooped up some of the corn chips with generous globs of guacamole and sour cream, spooned some onions on top, and ate with an appreciation only one step removed from manic glee. "I wonder if this problem of yours is somehow related to the changes you underwent 2 summers ago." Puzzled, Dom said,
"What changes?"
"You know what I'm talking about. When I first met you in Portland 6 years ago, you were a pale, retiring, unadventurous slug."
"Slug?"
"It's true, and you know it. You were bright, talented, but a slug nonetheless. You know why you were a slug? I'll tell you why. You had all those brains and all that talent, but you were afraid to use them. You were afraid of competition, failure, success, life. You just wanted to plod along unnoticed. You dressed drably, spoke almost inaudibly, dreaded calling attention to yourself. You took refuge in the academic world because there was less competition there. God, man, you were a timid rabbit, burrowing in the earth and curling up in its den."
"Oh, yeah? If I was all that disgusting, why on earth did you ever go out of your way to strike up a friendship with me?"
"Because, you thick-headed booby, I saw through your masquerade. I saw beyond the timidity, saw through the practiced dullness and the mask of insipidness. I sensed something special in you. Saw glimpses and glimmers of it. That's what I do, you know. I see what other people can't. That's what any good artist does. He sees what most cannot."
"And you called me insipid."
"It's true. About what an artist does, and about you being a rabbit. Remember how long you knew me before you found enough confidence to admit being a writer? 3 months!
Well, in those days, I wasn't really a writer.
You had drawers full of stories. More than 100 short stories, not one of which had ever been submitted to any publication anywhere.
Not just because you were afraid of rejection, you were afraid of acceptance, too. Afraid of success. How many months did I have to hammer at you till you finally sent the couple to market?
I don't remember.
I do. 6 months. I wheedled and cajoled and demanded and pushed and nagged until you broke down and started submitting stories. I'm a persuasive character, but prying you out of your rabbit hole was almost beyond even my formidable talent for persuasion.
With an almost obscene enthusiasm, Parker scooped up dripping masses of nachos and stuffed himself. After slurping his margarita, he said,
"Even when your short story started selling, you wanted to stop. I had to push you constantly. And after I left Oregon and came back here, when I left you on your own again, you only continued to submit stories for a few months. Then you crawled back into your rabbit hole."
Dom did not argue, because everything the painter said was true. After leaving Oregon and returning to his home in Laguna, Parker continued to encourage Dom through letters and phone calls, but long-distance encouragement was insufficient to motivate him. He had convinced himself that, after all, he was not a writer worthy of publication, in spite of more than a score of sales he'd racked up in less than a year. He stopped sending his stories to magazines and quickly fabricated another shell to replace the one Parker had helped him break out of. Though he was still compelled to produce stories, he reverted to his previous habit of consigning them to his deepest desk drawer, with no thought of marketing them. Parker had continued to urge him to write a novel, but Dom had been certain that his talent was too humble, and that he was too lacking in self-discipline to tackle such a large and complex project. He tucked his head down once more, spoke softly, walked softly, and tried to live a life that was largely beneath notice.
"But the summer before last, all of that changed," Parker said. "Suddenly, you throw away your teaching career. You take the plunge and become a full-time writer. Almost overnight, you change from an accountant type to a risk-taker, a bohemian. Why? You've never been clear about that. Why?"
Dominic frowned, considered the question for a moment, and was surprised that he had not thought about it much before this.
"I don't know why. I really don't know."
At the University of Portland, he had been up for tenure, had felt that he would not be given it, and had grown panicky at the prospect of being cast loose from his sheltered moorings. Obsessed with keeping a low profile, he had faded too completely from the notice of the campus movers and shakers, and when the time arrived for the tenure board to consider him, they had begun to question whether he had embraced the university with sufficient enthusiasm to warrant a grant of lifetime employment. Dom was enough of a realist to see that if the board refused tenure, he would find it difficult to obtain a position at another university, for the hiring committee would want to know why he had been turned down at Portland. In an uncharacteristic burst of self-promotion, hoping to slip out from under the university's axe before it fell, he applied for positions at institutions in several western states, emphasizing his published stories because that was the only thing worth emphasizing. Mountain View College in Utah, with a student body of only 4,000, had been so impressed by the list of magazines in which he had published that they flew him from Portland for an interview. Dom made a considerable effort to be more outgoing than he had ever been before. He was offered a contract to teach English and creative writing with guaranteed tenure. He had accepted, if not with enormous delight, then at least with enormous relief. Now, on the terrace of Las Brisas, as the California sun slid out from behind a band of white jeweled clouds, he took a sip of his beer, sighed, and said,
"I left Portland late in June that year. I had a U-Haul trailer hooked to the car, just a small one, filled mostly with books and clothes. I was in a good mood. Didn't feel as if I'd failed at Portland. Not at all. I just felt, well, that I was getting a fresh start. I was really looking forward to life at Mountain View. In fact, I don't remember ever being happier than the day I hit the road.
Parker Fane nodded knowingly.
Of course you were happy. You had tenure in a hick school where not much would be expected of you, where your introversion would be excused as an artist's temperament.
A perfect rabbit hole, huh?
Exactly. So why didn't you wind up teaching in Mountain View?
I told you before. At the last minute, when I got there, the second week in July, I just couldn't bear the idea of going on with the kind of life I'd had before. I was tired of being a mouse, a rabbit.
Just like that, you were repelled by the low-key life. Why?
It wasn't very fulfilling.
But why were you tired of it all of a sudden?
I don't know.
You must have some idea. Haven't you thought about it a lot?
Surprisingly, I haven't, Dom said.
He stared out to sea for a long moment, watching a dozen sailboats and a large yacht as they moved majestically along the coast.
I just now realized how amazingly little I thought about it. Strange.
I'm usually too self-analytical for my own good, but in this case I've never probed very deeply.
Uh-huh,
Parker exclaimed. I knew I was on the right trail. The changes you went through then are somehow related to the problems you're having now. So go on. So you told the people at Mountain View that you didn't want their job anymore?
They weren't happy.
And you took a tiny apartment in town?
One room, plus kitchen and bath. Not much of a place. Nice view of the mountains, though.
Decided to live on your savings while you wrote a novel?
There wasn't a lot in the bank, but I'd always been frugal.
Impulsive behavior. Risky. And not a damn bit like you, Parker said.
So, why did you do it? What changed you?
I guess it was building for a long time. By the time I got to Mountain View, my dissatisfaction was so great that I had to change.
Parker leaned back in his chair.
No good, my friend. There must be more to it than that.
Listen, by your own admission, you were as happy as a pig in shit when you left Portland with your U-Haul. You had a job with a livable salary, guaranteed tenure, in a place where no one was ever going to demand too much of you. All you had to do was settle down in Mountain View and disappear. But by the time you got there, you couldn't wait to throw it all over, move into a garret, and risk eventual starvation, all for your art. What the hell happened to you during that long drive to Utah? Something must have given you a real jolt. Something big enough to knock you out of your complacency.
Nope, it was an uneventful trip.
Not inside your head, it wasn't.
Dominic shrugged.
As far as I remember, I just...